Thank you for being here tonight and sharing in our worship time together. How many of you stayed for the luncheon today? You went over and ate the... Hope it all goes to your hips. No, I seriously mean that. I went home, and I'm on Nutrisystem, Garrett. I've started Nutrisystem. I opened up. I told her, whatever, it doesn't matter. That's the thing, it does, yeah, whatever. And I had, came in a little tub, cream potato soup. Put water in it. Put water in all this. Put water in it, and it becomes magically soup in a minute and a half. And if that's all you eat, you'll lose weight. Well, I guess so. You know, I should have span system or something years ago and make some money. First thing I hear when I told my son, you know, about not staying for the dinner because of the dinner, because I was weak and I knew I would eat. And I would have eaten healthy portions. And when I first pulled up in the parking lot, I hear the first words, honest to goodness, I hear. Two ladies walking up, men at the door, talking about how great the fellowship dinner was. How stuffed he was. Where's he at? There you are, yeah. Stuffed he was. Went home, laid on the couch, slept there all day. Well, I'm preaching at you tonight. Oh, man. I can't wait to get home to that next meal. It's coming. Look, I get dessert with it, though. A cookie. A man. Get a cookie at my age. And what's sad is I look forward to it. And really do. I spoke this morning about our mission, and the truth is I didn't get covered everything I wanted to cover on that. But I got the thought out across. And it's that we should be missionaries, and that we ought to have in our mind who it is we're trying to reach, who it is we're trying to bring to God. For I found if you don't have in mind anyone, that's usually what happens. You don't bring anyone. And someone might say, well, I have everyone in mind. Well, then you're better than just about everybody I know. Because I don't know anyone who has everyone in mind. I walk into a pulpit, I have everyone in here in mind when I preach. That's not so. I told you, we have this part down. But the Bible was mostly about what happens out there, not what happens in here. The majority of it's about out there. Hezekiah, in Isaiah 37, Judah was surrounded by the Assyrian army, and Sennacherib sent a message in of how he was going to defeat him. And Hezekiah made this statement, and I think it's so applicable to us in so many different ways. He simply said, today is a day of trouble. If you watch news, what do you see? It's trouble. You read the newspaper, you go from one article to another, and it's just bad things after bad things. Somebody got the idea of putting the good things on and writing a paper with the good news. Nobody bought it. They all went to the other thing. Our world is in trouble. Would you agree with that? I mean, we're just I'll also say this. It's not the world I grew up in. The world we're in right now is not the world I grew up in. I grew up in a good time in my mind. I left the house and would just be gone all day. We'd go play ball. We'd go do whatever. And I'd come home that night. My grandkids, we don't even let out in the yard. I don't know how it is up here, but in Nashville, especially Antioch, you know, you wear camo if you go out in the yard. If they're going to drive by, they're going to have to stop to get you. But it's a hard time. And as a minister, you preach at other churches and stuff. When you go, when you're asked to come speak to someone, what do you speak about? What is it you need? Well, I'm sure he's taking care of the needs. But what specifically? And as a preacher, sometimes you don't know. I don't know what you really need. So my sermons this week will be generic in nature. Well, not really. I'm going to hit specifics. And what they're going to be are specifics to me. For what I have found in all the years I've been doing this is that we're pretty much all alike. Y'all were so kind to me today and you talked to me and we discussed different things and all. But you know, if I'd have gone to another church on down the road, we'd have been nice to each other, we'd have talked things. Well, we're all pretty much alike. No matter where you, and that's a pretty good thing though. In the church that you have brothers and sisters all around you. But man, do you feel stressed? You know, of course, I have a heart doctor now. I had them before because I had to have stents put in them back in 2001. After I had the stents put in, I got to where I could sit on the bench in the ball games. But I couldn't stand and yell and stuff, so I taught. And only one coach can stand. The assistant coaches can't stand against the rules. Technical, if they stand up. So I told the ref, Coach Carter here is going to be the head coach tonight. I'm just sitting. I don't do that real good. I found out even after stent surgery, in a one particular play, I jump up. And one of my girls beside me, who'd already graduated, but she came back and sat on a bench with us, grabbed me. And when I looked at her, she said, Coach Spann, don't do that. I said, I won't, because it scared me too. But you know, this is a rough time we live in. My heart doctor gave me this great advice. Joey, stress kills people. You have to get rid of stress. Now I'm stressed on trying to, you know. I asked him, I said, are you stressed? Are you stressed? And he laughed and he said, yeah. How do you get rid of stress? And I'm not going to tell you how because I don't know how. Well, trust totally in God. I still fight stress and I don't know if anyone in here trusts in God any more than I do. But I still battle that stress thing. I still, because things concern me. Let me tell you this. What is really frustrating is when you can't do anything about the stuff you're needing to do something about. Woman at Ezel, we had a game that day, and I wanted to be alone just before the end of school, and I went off into a room, and she came in. She's one of the secretaries up there in the administration office. And she goes to church with me, and I had her kids as they were little growing up in my youth group and all. And their boys were grown now. And this one, she said about this one, she said, you know, Randy, not doing too good, Joey. And I'm trying just to rest and clear my head a little bit. I said, is that right? What's wrong? He tried to commit suicide. I said, what? And for the next 30 minutes, she explained to me the things going on in that young man's life that drove him to the point of where he wanted to commit suicide, and also to the point where they as parents were just torn up. And when it was over, and I prayed with them, when it was over, I really hadn't done anything for them. Their boy still felt that. As she walked away, that boy's still in that condition. She and her husband will still think, and I think sometimes, you know, what good? I go to a Nashville Christian ball game to scout them one night. This was the same week. I walk in, and I'm just going to relax and watch ball and just scout a little bit. Before it starts, a girl sees me from the other side, yells at me, and comes to me, you know, and we start talking. And we're before the game, and I only made it to where the underneath the goal is. Come inside here, and I'm leaning against this wall talking to her, and they're warming up, shooting layups all around us. She says, you know I'm getting ready to be divorced. I said, no, because I know her husband too. I said, what happened? 30 minutes later, we're still against that wall. And I've missed the whole game. You know, the game's gone on, but in talking here, because this is so much more important. And when we were through and she walked off and I walked away, I didn't solve anything. You try to give comforting words and you try to give, you know, and two or three other things like that happened that week. And so I was preparing my sermons, and I say this sometimes, a lot of times a preacher's sermons are what's in his life. Then I always follow that up with saying this. Now, if I preach on adultery next week, don't think that that's in my, what's in my life right now. But a preacher, a lot of times, that's how we judge the needs of the church. I know, and so I wrote out this sermon. What good am I? They come to me with needs, and one little girl knocked on my door. And I'm teaching, so I'm just saying, and open my door, and she's crying, bawling. Same week, it all was that week, and she said, "Coach Ben, can I talk to you?" And I just told my class, you know, y'all just be quiet, I'll be right back. And we went up the hall, and her mother had been a great friend of ours, was a good friend of ours, and had died of cancer. Was a great mother. The stepmother, who was now in the family, had gone to church with them and was a great woman at church. But when they got married, things changed. She asked me in that little room, she said, "Coach, why did God take my mother away from me? I had the greatest mother in the world. And now I've got this. Why?" And so I you ever felt so discouraged? I wrote this sermon out following that week. Jerry Barber is a preacher in Nashville area and a real good friend of mine. We ministered together. And Jerry was coming. I was getting ready to preach that morning. And I was in my office going over my sermon that morning. And Jerry come walking by the office. I said, "Hey, Jerry, come here a second. I want to run this by you. I think I'm getting ready to preach a sermon that no one else needs." And he said, "Well, what is it?" And so I gave him the little bitty outline of it. And he says, "Joey, I don't think there'll be anyone who doesn't need it." So when I travel and I speak at different churches, I bring this lesson when I can. It's not a lesson to, look in your Bible, Ezekiel 22. It's not a lesson to stomp on toes. Oh, this morning, as you're looking at that, and I'm stalling as you're turning to it. This morning I did that lesson in Sunday school. When I did that at Mount Juliet, one of the men came up to me after, and real country sounding. Imagine that in Mount Juliet, a country sounding guy. And he said, "Man, I wouldn't have worn these if I'd known you were going to preach that sermon." Now look, Dan, he had on Jesus sandals, they call them, flip-flop looking things. And he said, "I'd have worn my hard-toed shoes from work if I'd known you were going to preach that sermon." Sometimes lessons are meant to be like that. I want to show you this verse. This verse helped me in that time where I know I'm the light of the world. Talk to you about that this morning. But what good is a light if no one listens? You know, when you preach, sometimes you don't know if anyone's getting this. Are you getting this? Are you listening to what I'm saying? I had one guy come to me and I was counseling him, and I gave him advice that even while I was speaking it, thought, "Dog, this is good advice." I was impressed with the words that were coming out. But you know how you read somebody? I said, "Son, you're not even listening to me, are you? I'm giving you the best advice I've ever given anyone, and you're not even hearing it." Yeah, I am. "No, you're not." What good is the light if you're not turned on? What good is, I'm the salt of the earth. What good is that if we're not used? What purpose? We're not good at warnings. People aren't good at warnings. Speaking down, I did this talk down in Florida. State trooper came up to me afterwards. Said, "I pulled over a woman speeding." Said, "I went up to her window, had my ticket book pad out, was getting ready to write a ticket, and she said, 'Please don't, just give me a warning. Just give me a warning.'" He said, "I looked up in the dash and there was a pack of cigarettes up there. I reached in, pulled out the pack of cigarettes, turned the warning label to her and said, 'This will kill you.' And he said, 'Ma'am, if you won't listen to this warning, why in the world would I think you'd listen to me warning you about speeding?" And she sat there and he wrote out her ticket, handed it to her. My sister got in my car with me. I was driving her to Lawrenceburg, 6 a.m. in the morning. The radio was on. They were talking. My sister was a smoker. And she's lighting up, you know, and she's getting in, lighting up. And on it is about smoking and cancer and all this stuff. First thing, this is honest goodness true, I wasn't paying that close attention because we had to get to Lawrenceburg for some reason. And she stopped and said, "Oh, no, because this smoking will kill you and it will kill those around you." And she said, "Oh, no, I can't hear that this morning." Click. Well, that's just us, though. We're not real good with warnings. Look here at Ezekiel, 22nd chapter, 29 and 30. "The people of the land used oppressions, committed robbery. They mistreated the poor and the needy, and they wrongfully oppressed the stranger. So I sought out a man among them who would make a wall and stand in the gap before me on behalf of the land, that I should not destroy it. But I found no one." But I have marked in my Bible, "stand in the gap." And this verse hit me. That's what I'm doing. I'm standing in the gap. You are too. Those of us who are Christians in here, those of you who are parents, those of you who have friends, all of us are people who stand in the gap, stand between the living and the dead, just as Moses did that between God and Israel, just as Aaron literally stood between the living and the dead, between Israel and dying. We stand in the gap, just as our Lord and Savior stood in the gap for us. We stand in that gap. When God looked out over the land and he said, "I need someone who will stand here between us," but I couldn't find anyone. And I tell you tonight, we are those who stand in the gap. But I also at the same time want to warn you about this. There are some characteristics that I noticed during that week, and I wrote them down, that happens to people who stand in the gap. Sometimes you preach a sermon, and in preaching the sermon, you'll preach it in such a way that you do it to stir up emotions and get someone to respond. You can do that. You do some sermons that might bring about some guilt feelings. And here's my feeling on that. I'm fine with preaching about guilt because I tell you why. You can't make me feel guilty if I'm not guilty. And if I am guilty, please make me feel guilty. Show me where I'm wrong so I can change. I don't have any problem with guilt sermons. This sermon is not that. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with all long suffering. I'm going to do the exhorting. You're going to do the long suffering for the next little bit. But I'm going to do nothing but try to encourage those of you who stand in the gap. And there's a reason that I want to do that. Because I stand right there every day of my life. Every waking moment just about. And a lot of you do too. Where you stand between those who care and those who don't care. And I'm talking about family members and loved ones who you love. You want them to go to church, but they don't really want to go to church. You've taught them better than that. They just have, you have a friend who you're trying to bring the Lord, but they just don't really, they're not that way. They're not into the church thing. And you love them and you care for them and just all kinds of ways to stand in the gap. Here's some characteristics of those who stand in the gap. I'm going to give you three. Number one, the first one, not in any particular order, except this is the first one that I noticed. That when you stand in the gap, when you get out there, you're going to be, you will suffer this feeling of loneliness. When you stand up for what's right, and those who don't aren't for the right, and you stand up for God, when God looks around for someone to stand up, and you stand, like Ephesians 6 says, having done all to stand, when you find yourself standing up for God, and you're standing there, and I'm not talking about right preaching righteousness, I'm talking about just living your life right and trying to treat them right and to get them to live right. I'm not talking about quoting scriptures, though that definitely doesn't hurt anything. I'm talking about just trying to reach them. There is a feeling of loneliness that comes over those who stand in the gap. In 1 Kings 19, Elijah fought against the prophets of Baal. Remember that? 450 prophets of Baal. And they were 400 from Ashtoreth over there too. But these 450, the one he really went after, and he defeated them in front of all the people around there. And then the queen came to town, and there he is running away. Do you remember when God found him under that bush? Do you remember what he said? Listen, I only am left. It's just me. Have you ever felt that way? You listening, moms and dads, husbands and wives, teenagers? Have you ever felt like it's just you? You're the only one trying in this relationship. You're the only one in your known world who's trying to do this thing right. Elijah said, it's just me. And God said, no, it's not. No, it's not. But perception is reality, isn't it? When you perceive to be alone, alone you are. You can be in a crowded room and be alone. There's somebody maybe even here right now in this crowd who knows what it feels like even now to feel alone. Just because people are around you doesn't stop that feeling. I remember when Paul in 2 Timothy chapter 4 was in prison and Paul said, all men forsook me. Now except the Lord, he didn't, but everyone else left him. Paul knew what it was like to feel all alone. Jesus knew what it was like. Isaiah said they'll leave him. Isaiah 53 says they'll forsake him. The Gospels said the disciples ran off and left him. And Jesus watched them leave. He knew they would leave. He knew he'd be there alone. But he had God. And then on the cross, you hear those words, my God. And these are the words of all the words on there. All of them are so powerful, though. I don't know if I can really say this. But they're powerful to me anyways. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? And there he was, in his deepest point of hurt, alone. And it's a horrible, horrible feeling to be alone. There are some wives who are bringing their children up, and I don't know about anyone here, but I know at a church I was at, we had a woman who brought her kids to church every Sunday. I mean, she got up, she got them dressed. Husband didn't help at all. Didn't help at all. She got them dressed and brought them every Sunday, just as faithful as could be. 1 Peter 3 says, for the women to live their lives in such a way that they might win their husbands by their conversation, by their manner of living, and not by the preaching of the word, but just by the husband watching the wife and seeing this is real. There are some wives, and there are some husbands who are doing it. We had a professor at Lipscomb when I was at Smith Springs. I got him to come speak one night at Smith Springs. I was still in college, and he came over, and I gave him a ride home that night. And I'll never forget this. This was back when I was in college, about 10, 15 years ago or more. I drove him home, and every word he's saying, you know, I'm sort of idolizing. Because, I mean, this is Dr. So-and-so. He's in my car. He may even know my name when this is over. He got out, and I was watching him. I said, good night. And he's walking up this dark path up onto the porch. And, you know, being a youth minister, I have to wait till they get in the house, you know, before you pull off. But let me tell you what went through my mind. I had been told his wife didn't attend church anymore. She wasn't supportive in that area of his life anymore. And I watched him go up at that dark path alone. And that stuck with me through all these years. It's a horrible feeling to be alone. You know, parents know what it's like to be alone. When your kid begins to grow up and they begin to get their little attitudes and begin to get to where they know everything and you become dumb and they become smart and it happens overnight somehow. And Man, the relationships get strained, and you begin to wonder how things are going on, and you want them to do what's right, but they don't necessarily want to do what's right. You put down rules that are for their good, but they don't understand it's for their good. My dad didn't put down a rule and me say, "Oh, Dad, thanks. You really do love me. You know, you're it, Dad." My daughter and my son never did that to me either. They didn't thank me for the rules which I had, but I had to put down rules. I know the feeling as a parent to lay down the rules and them not like it. My grandkids and daughter and them have moved back into us, with going through some hard times, and so they're living with us. So Peggy and I will drive around here as long as we can before we have to go back home. Peggy's not, "Please take me." Okay, come on. But you know, I had to, Joey's named after me. And I had to spat him yesterday, I guess, or day before. And I don't whip him. But he said something, and I popped his leg. And man, it hurt his feelings more than it hurt him, you know, for me to do it. And I was really trying to hurt him more than his feelings, though. But he deserved it. And he needed it. He needed it. But I know that feeling of punishing a child that you're trying to help, and them leave, and you feel alone. Those of you whose children haven't grown yet, you'll remember back when you were a child. I've set down rules for my child, and I've gone in my bedroom after talking. When Kelly hit teenage years, who is it has those three little boys 1 year apart? Man. You know, you think now, this is horrible. They're little and they're all 1 year apart. Wait. Just wait. Be good to the grandparents, because you're going to need them. I remember setting down rules and going in my bedroom and laying there and just looking at the wall. Did you ever do that? Just looking at the ceiling. Couldn't go to sleep. My daughter, back in the day, she's 30-something now, but Ozzy Osbourne was for real back then. And that whole group, they weren't allowed in my house. And I didn't allow my daughter to put posters up of them on her wall. I didn't allow her to have the CDs of them. I didn't allow that. Some people think, you know, well, that's, I don't know, well, I don't care what the people think. I know what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. My daughter disagreed with me. Everybody's doing this. That means y'all weren't very good parents if everyone was doing this. But I told her, I said, "No, sweetie, I think heroes go up on your walls." They put some things up, but I didn't let those guys go up on the walls. I just didn't do it. I think a kid decorates their room with their heroes. I don't want those. You're not going to listen to that in this house. I'd go in there. She had a little shelf, you know, where you put the little CDs in there. Julian, you know what a CD is, hon? Okay. And I would every now and then just glance through there, and I'd find one, throw it away. She'd come back. "Dad, have you seen whatever? Ozzy Osbourne biting off bat's head, whatever?" And I said, "Yeah, I saw that. Where is it?" I threw it away. "That wasn't mine. That belonged to Kathy." I said, "Man, Kathy's going to be mad at you." And I did. And I told her, "Son, that stuff's not allowed in the room." I did it again. I did it numerous times. I'd find shorts that she would wear. And I'll tell you this. Men, I think, we see it different than women see it. They would say, "Those are just shorts." And I'd say, "No, they're not just shorts. Because I know the guys. Those aren't just shorts." I'd go in sometimes in the laundry and I'd find a certain pair of shorts that I never liked. Threw them away. Then the dryer got the blame. You know how it eats clothes up. Just throw them away. You ever gone to your kid's room and get ready to open the door and it was locked? Do you ever have that happen? Boom. "Open the door, hon. Open the door.
Well, you smoking pot in there? What's going on? I know nothing's going on there, but I want the door open. People come in. I want the door open. You don't trust me. Okay, we understand that now. That's out of the way. I trust you to be a kid. That's all. Somebody told me they said that their kids sit wherever they want in the auditorium. They sit in front and their kids sit behind them and play around church. So I said, your kid doesn't get the blame for that. They're acting like a kid. Who's acting like the parent here? And with this, I knocked on the door and I told her, I said, hon, don't lock the door anymore. Yeah, raise your hand if you ever had that rule. Did anybody have that? You don't lock the door? Okay, a bunch, good. Come back again. Right into the door. What? That's a lot softer than that wood. That hurt. Just bam. Open the door. Just a second. No, open it now. You know. Yes, sir, what's wrong? I told you not to lock the door. You know what I did? I took the door handle out. Just took it off. Took it in the other room. That door, of course, had that hole in it. She'd shut her door, boom, and then it would right back open. And you know, she said, thank you, Daddy, for loving me and doing that. No, she wouldn't speak to me. Mad. I don't care. I don't care. The doors, you're going to do what I say do. You can understand it, not understand it. We're too much into the understanding thing. I think this is a personal opinion. Too much into the understanding thing. And we want to be in agreement on this. Thank God my parents weren't in agreement with me. I had to agree with them on things. They knew more than I did. She came to me in a week or two, and she said, Dad, do you think I could have the door handle back on? I said, sure, hon. Don't lock your door anymore. Put the thing back on there. And we had an understanding. But you know, there have been many a time. I remember the first time Kelly, when she was real little, told Peg, I hate you. Peg came in the room with me. She hates me. She hates me. Ah, she doesn't even know what hate is, hon. You did what needed to be done. Don't worry about it. Yeah, but she hates me. I said, you know, man up. Pull your skirt up down there, Nancy. So I spanked her. Mike cries. And have you ever spanked your child and went in the other room and you cry? I've done that. Killed me to spank them. But I had to. My son's so hard-headed. I was getting ready to... Kelly would do this too. I guess it's just kids. It's come to think of it. Both of them were like this. He'd say, don't say another word. Okay. No. Not another word. Get out. As I'm leaving, I said, what? Get out. Spot the little leg. Don't say anything. And I was leaving out and I was... And I'm trying to get out without hearing anything. I don't want to whip them. And I'm shutting the door, and they have to do it. Shut the door. So I went back in with my son. I remember this one. I went back to him and said, son, don't. So I smacked his leg just a little bit harder. And he manned up. And I understood that. And I was a little bit proud of him. He's fighting the tears. I said, and I'm going to leave him as a man. I said, okay, don't say anything. And I get ready to leave. Didn't make me cry. And I sat down beside him. He's just a little boy at the time. Put my arm around him. I said, son, I understood what you were doing. You were being brave and courageous. I understood that, and I was proud of you for trying to be a man in that. But one thing you'll learn in life, there's a real thin line between being brave and being stupid. And son, you just stepped over that line. I said, you're going to cry now. And they did what I learned. Cry on the first lick. And then the parents quit. They think they've taught you. You wait till that eighth or ninth lick. That's no good. Just cry right away. Kids, I know the feeling of even in a home situation of feeling alone. And not having anywhere to turn, and you wonder, you're not Solomon, but you know, the hardest thing I do is raise kids. Jim Bill McAteer said, raising children is like driving down a road at night with the headlights in the back. We should have done that. We should have gone there. We should have done this. Because I'm not Solomon. Yet you do the best you can for your kids. And let me give you something here. As a teacher and someone who's worked in the youth ministry for so many years and been around kids almost every day of my life, don't seek to be their friend. Last thing they need is a 40-year-old friend, 30-year-old friend, you know. I have good relationships with my students, and I consider actually friends, but I don't seek to be their friend. I'm their teacher, and I'll respect them, and I'll treat them right, and hopefully that comes back. But we're not going to cross that line to where, oh, I want to be their friend. I've told my ball team this. I don't need you to be my friend. I've got all the friends I need in this world. I need you to do what I say do. And whether you're my friend or not, doesn't bother me at all. We're to be parents. And also in reaching out to people who are lost, we're to take that stand, even if it means you stand alone. Do you remember when David went to fight Goliath? Who ran out there with David? Nobody. All of Israel let him go by himself. And I tell you this, if you feel like you're alone, then stand alone. If others stand with you, then stand with others. But if you stand alone for Christ at work, alone for Christ in your home, alone for Christ wherever, then stand alone. Someone said, but I'm scared. I told them, I said, well, suck your thumb. Get your little Linus blanket. Do whatever it is you need to do, but do what you're supposed to do. Just do what you're supposed to do. I have found God blesses those who do what they're supposed to do. It's lonely, though, when you stand in the gap. Let me tell you something else. You become the target when you're in the gap. When you stand in between them and what they want to do and them and what's right and wrong and stuff, you become the target. Again, David pulled up there and with Goliath, and I'm going to talk about this later in the week. I love that sermon. But David says, I'll fight him. And Eliab, his brother, comes out and jumps him and argues with him. When you stand, you say, I'll do it. Be ready. Someone's going to come after you. You're going to have adversaries come your way. My cousin was a policeman in Toledo, and we got a phone call. He'd been shot, and we needed to hurry up there. They didn't know if he was going to make it or not. He'd been shot 2 or 3 times. When we got there, we found out he'd answered a domestic call, and that was the worst call that a policeman answers. The wife had called the police. The husband was beating her. When the police got there, the man took off running up the stairs, and they went and they were tackling him. She switched sides on them. She grabbed Ronnie's revolver out of his holster and shot him right there on the steps. There he was trying to help her. She shot him. My son-in-law served over in Iraq. And one of the things he came back that was so hard for him to grip was he said, we were trying to help those people and they hated us. It's the ones who you are reaching out for who come after you. The prophets. Jesus himself said, which of the prophets did you not stone? The very people the prophets were teaching, or your fathers, the very people that they were teaching are the ones who killed them. Who was it who killed Jesus? Well, his people. Who killed the apostles? You stand in the gap, and you're going to find yourself standing alone, and you'll also find yourself becoming the target. Here's the hardest thing. The very person you're trying to help will be the one who turns on you. My kids had an unusual thing that when I would spank them growing up, and this was, and I didn't teach them this, they just did this. Kelly would come back in the room a little bit later, and would say, Daddy, I'm sorry. And I mean, a weight lifted off. She got it. I knew this little girl who her sister played ball for me. She was a little first grader. She came around all the time. She was so sweet and so precious and a beautiful little girl. And she came to all of her practices, and I had her in class and PE, and we loved each other. And she grew up and up and up, and then she came out for my ball team. She got old enough to play for me. And one day she wasn't doing what she was supposed to do, and I came down real hard on her. The first time ever she'd seen that guy. And man, I felt like dirt. To practice, but I still did it. Just walked away. After practice. Hey, Laurel, come here a second, hon. She came over and I put my arm around her. I said, now listen, Laurel. You know, when I got on to you a while ago, do you know what that was about? And I'd already gone over my speech. And she interrupted me. She said, yes, sir, you're trying to make me a better player. I said, that's right, hon, go on. She got it. They don't usually get that. The very one you're trying to help, be your friend at work or a family member or a child. I give this to parents, and there are a lot of parents in this room. I'll share this with you. I didn't whip my kids a whole lot. Whipped them when I thought they needed it. Didn't beat them with objects, Peggy. I answered my door. Cops were there. Can I tell this story? Yeah. And cops are, the police are there, not cops. And yes, sir. Do you have a car such and such? Yes, sir. Do you have a wife and a son, a child? Yes, sir. Could we see them? I said, well, they're not here. I don't know where they are. They'd gone. Peggy had been driving and Michael was not obeying. And back then didn't have to have the seat belts. And you could, those of my, you remember getting away from your parents. Hey, ho, can't get me now. And Michael had done it, and Peg had pulled off her little flip-flop and was now coming after him to reach all the way across because he's down in the corner. And Mike, we had him in karate. He used to make Peggy so mad because he'd block her stuff. But she is swinging at him. And she's getting off Harding Place exit, and she comes to a stop, and she's stopped. And while you stopped, you get your licks in, you know. And she goes over there trying, he's down that corner. And she's not hitting them, but to the car behind her, and they got on their cell phone, called the cops. They came to my house to arrest my wife. I told them where she was. And so I told them, I said, he said, would your wife hit your son with a shoe? I said, there's a good possibility that could happen. I said, you know, he laughed. He said, well, I've got kids too. I understand. And they let it go. They just had to check it out. My teenagers have this way about them, and this bugs me, and I don't allow them to do it in my classroom. The rolling of eyes. You ever seen that? Or this sound. You say something. Eyes roll and stuff. That wasn't allowed in my household. It just wasn't. I understand that that's a kid saying to an adult, stupid. You're so stupid. But they can't say those words, so they roll those eyes. Well, my child would do that, and I'd pop them right here. They're not hard, but just that little pop on the head. You know, to knock a little boom. And just a pop. But those eyes would roll, boom, and the eyes set right back, you know. It's a health technique. But I would pop them because I know what they're saying. Stupid. And I'm saying, this is adult talk, stupider. And just a little pop. Not going to let them do that. I tell my students, sometimes they roll their eyes at me and I stop. See, you rolled your eyes at me. You don't like what I did. I offended you. Sweetheart, I don't let my daughter roll her eyes at me, and I love her. I don't hardly even know you. You can't do that. But you know, sometimes when you do what's right, you spank your child, or you do in any other area of your life, that loneliness comes on, and then the hatred towards you. Some of you have tried to reach a friend with Christ, and they almost hate you. That you catch a lot of grief for doing it. You become the target. The last thing is this. This is a short one. The feeling of failure. When I get older congregations, when I talk about this, they stop at the back door and they share with me stories of their children who are grown, who aren't in the church anymore. And these people are brokenhearted. There's a sense when you stand in the gap of being a failure, not being worth anything. And the guilt pours on you. And here's an example of it. You know, if Jesus had hung around Judas like he did Peter, maybe Judas wouldn't have been as bad as he was. If Peter, James, and John and Judas had been with him everywhere. But no, that was Judas's doings. His fault. If Paul had given Demas just a little bit more attention, maybe he would have been known like we know Timothy. No, that's Demas's doing. Too many of us pick the guilt up from those we love and we put it on our shoulders. Put it on our shoulders. And weighs us down even more. That's their doing. Got time for a funny story. I was preaching, and sometimes you'll say things up here and they sound right up here. One night I was preaching about, Job and the whale. And Peggy is just laughing, her and my son are laughing right here, and I'm preaching, you know. Every time I'm saying the wrong guys, finally I stop and just say, "What is it? What are you laughing at?" She says, "It's Jonah." I say, "Women can't talk in church. Be quiet." Now I say, But once you've said it, it sort of sticks. I was preaching. I was trying to emphasize this. Sometimes the guilt's on them. If the teenagers will choose their own stuff. And you can't blame yourself. I said, if my son calls me, and he tells me, "Dad, I'm at a party and they're getting ready to do some dope, and you know I've never done any drugs. Can I do it?" And if I say yes, then blame me. You know? But if he would call me and say, "Dad, can I do some drugs?" I'd say, "No, you can't do drugs. Are you crazy? Get out of there." If he called me back a little bit later, "Dad, you know I've never drank. Can I have some liquor here? They're drinking here. What you think?" Again, if I say yeah, well then blame me. But he knew not to call me on that. I said, "No, you can't drink. Are you kidding?" Well, I'm doing that else, and you get the point I'm making. Now I'm preaching mighty bold, boy. My son called me, and if I tell him, "No, you can't do that. No, you can't drink. No, you can't do drugs." And then he calls me, and I actually did this. Peggy's riding home just crying in the car. I said, "What is wrong with you?" She says, "Do you know what you said?" I said, "Yeah, usually." She said, "No, did you get what you said in the pulpit?" And she told me this. And I said, "No, I didn't." She said, "Yes. I did the drinking. I did the drugs." Then I said, "Get a phone call from my son. Dad, at this party, everybody's having sex. Is it all right if I have sex?" What I meant was, "No, you can't." You know, but what I said was, "Dad, can we, is it okay if I have sex? I'll be right over there." That's what I said. "I'll be right over." I meant I'll be over to get you. We're out of there. But I didn't catch it. And I asked a deacon that night, I said, "Did I really say that?" He said, "Joey, it was the most discipline I ever used to sit there and not laugh out loud at you while you were preaching." You know, you can't... Do you remember when Satan was after Peter, or was going to, and Jesus said, "Satan desires you that he may sift you as wheat, but I'm praying for you"? You know how we'd have handled that? How I'd have handled that? "Peter, Satan is after you. John, Andrew, come here. I want you to arrange around the clock apostle watch on Peter. We're going to be, Satan's after him. He's coming hard. We've got to be there with him." And we would set up a 24-hour watch. But you know how Jesus handled it? "I'm praying for you. You know what you ought to do." And he sent Peter out there. Now it's up to Peter. And that's the way it is with us in this world. As we stand in the gap, They make the decisions. I wish I could decide for them, but I can't. I feel lonely. I feel like the target. A lot of times I feel guilty. But it's not my guilt. It's the decisions which they themselves chose to make. I don't know where you stand in your life, in your relationship. I used a lot of little humor type things tonight, but the truth is this is a very serious matter of being able to stand up for God. To stand, look, if you're not the parent to your child, who is? I'm all for youth ministers. I was a youth minister for 25 years. I'll not trust my kid to a youth minister, though. My kid was my kid. You know, and I let them do things with youth ministers, and they're friends of mine and all that, but I'm going to teach the moral code. I just am. That's what God teaches. Parents do that. We got to have war. I pulled my daughter in as a seventh grader and said, from now on, hon. And she said, what is that? I said, from now on, me and you are going to be at war for the next few years. She said, what do you mean? I said, I'm just telling you, we're going to be at war. And you know we were. She had this boyfriend who became very possessive and stuff. And finally she broke up with him. And I heard her in the other room on the phone saying, I just loved it. Everything my dad ever said about this turned out to be right. And I'm in the other room saying, you know, Peggy, come here, you need to hear this. But I'm in the other room seriously, and I started to go in to talk to the guy on the phone, and I just stopped and listened. That everything he told me would happen has happened. I promised my daughter this. I promised her this. That day when she was just a little seventh grader, didn't have a clue what I was talking about. I said, we're going to be at war a whole lot. But I promise you this. I'll never stop fighting for you. You won't even know what's going on. But I promise you, I'll never stop. And that's where we all stand. Doing what we're supposed to do, whether they like it or whether they don't. Doing what we're supposed to do as parents, as Christians, as friends, as grandparents. Just doing what we're supposed to do. Tonight we do an invitation song right now. If there's anyone here who would like prayers, we'd love to pray with you. Anyone here not a Christian, we'd love to teach you about Christ and baptize you into Christ. We're going to stand and sing right now. If you need to come, I hope that you will.